a world of deceit, telling the truth is a revolutionary act. It's the David Knight Show.
As the clock strikes 13, it's Monday, the 2nd of February, year of our Lord, 2026. Well, we had some surprises over the weekend, didn't we? A large dump of Epstein files. Of course, it's still only about 50%, according even to the government. Where we learn more about our soulless elites who sold their souls a long time ago. Isn't it interesting how Trump was the guy who was going to protect us from the pedophile elites? It turns out he's protecting them instead. Maybe there's something we could learn from that about globalism and other things like that. And of course, his pick for Federal Reserve. Now we see that the fiat dollar evidently has been fixed. No more concerns about inflation, debt, anything. It's all fixed now with this new Fed pick. And we saw a shock in the price of gold and silver. We're going to talk about that today as well. And I guess one of the most surprising things to me was that there was no war over the weekend. You would think it'd be even more likely with the Epstein docs. I guess we could say he's going to wag the docs, but we're also going to take a look today at how to organize resistance. This is a lesson in tactics from people whose goals you may despise, but something very important nevertheless. And Melania, the film. And with all that, it does seem like Groundhog Day, because it is Groundhog Day today. Rise and shine.
Okay, campers, rise and shine, and don't forget your booties, because it's cold out there.
Well, they got that right, didn't they?
Every day. What is this, Miami Beach?
Hardly. And, you know, you can expect hazardous travel later today with that, you know, that blizzard thing.
Oh, that blizzard thing. Oh, well, here's the report. The National Weather Service is calling for a big blizzard thing.
Yes, they are. But, you know, there's another reason why.
It is Groundhog Day. This keeps happening over and over again in February.
Cold, okay. But the big question on everybody's lips.
Yeah, their chapped lips.
On their chapped lips, right. Do you think Phil's going to come out and see a shadow?
Punxsutawney Phil.
That's right, woodchuck chuckers. It's Groundhog Day. Get up and chase that hog out there.
Yeah. Ooh, come here, Groundhog.
Yeah, and actually, this morning he did see his, or whatever, did not see a shadow, whichever way it works. Anyway, he's predicting another 6 weeks of winter. That wasn't a hard prediction, was it? And of course, what a great movie that is. Who wouldn't want to have endless chances to get one day right? Just one day out of our life, right, that we could get everything correct. Well, I think we can comfortably say that he got this one right this year, even though his predictions have been pretty poor. He's gotten it only right about 30% of the time, says the National Organization for Oceanic and Atmospheric, NOAA, whatever they stand for. They have a vested interest in saying that they do a better job than a groundhog. Maybe they do with all of their computers slightly better, but you could flip a coin sometimes and do a little bit better. You know, people started accumulating at 3:30 in the morning, and he gets up at about 7:30. 7:25, they said, is the average time that he comes out. So I guess you could say that the groundhog is smarter than many of us, isn't he? If he waits to get up until the sun comes up. So last year, there were about 30,000 people there. I don't know. This year, that storm is very significant, very much more like the movie. Quite a bit of a storm everywhere. Your mic. Yeah, your mic. What are you saying, Lance? You said you think the reason that everybody remembers this is why?
So one remembers.
Yeah, the movie's the only reason anybody remembers the groundhog event, right? It certainly was a shot in the arm for them, wasn't it? It makes polka music at 3:30 in the morning look great, doesn't it? Anyway, so we have, I wonder if Punxsutawney Phil does election predictions. Because we had some interesting stuff that happened on Saturday. We had a Texas district that Trump had won by 17 points. and this thing flipped massively in the other direction. Something like a 32-point swing since his election in 2024. And so the Democrats are getting very excited about this. And, of course, some things will change, but not for the better if we get Democrats in instead of Republicans. But Trump pleaded ignorance Sunday when asked about a Texas Republican that he had endorsed just days ago. I don't know who this guy is. As they say, success has many fathers, but failure is an orphan, right? So this orphan lost pretty big to a Democrat, double digits loss. When asked about it on Sunday, about the trouncing, Trump says, I don't know. I didn't hear about it. Somebody ran it where? I don't have any idea what this is. Well, he's endorsed this candidate multiple times, most recently on the day before the election, Friday. It was on Saturday. And so he pretended that he didn't know anything about it on Sunday. He said, I'm not involved in that at all. It's a local Texas race. And the reporter said, but you endorse a Republican. Trump cut him off. He says, you mean I won by 17 points and this person lost? Things like that happen. Problem is, he's the reason. We're seeing his popularity plummet for obvious reasons. And the reporter says, doesn't it worry you? And he says, well, you don't know whether or not it's transferable, but I'm not on the ballot. So you don't know whether or not it's transferable. And this is the expectation games they all play and the denial games they all play. You know, Trump likes to take credit for races that he had absolutely nothing to do with, and he distanced himself from others. Saturday's results invite speculation that there's going to be a big switch going on when we get to the election in November. It was a 31.5-point swing in terms of the vote margin that this person won by versus what Trump did, which is, again, you're comparing Trump's race to this guy's race. Nevertheless, it was a strong Republican district. Why did you have a Democrat win by 14.5 points in a strong Republican district in Texas? There's something to see there. Since Trump took office, Democrats have flipped 8 Republican-held state legislative seats in special elections across 5 states. Republicans have flipped 0 Democrat seats. And, you know, I've mentioned many times what happened in 2010 in North Carolina. You had, for the first time since Reconstruction, a Republican legislature in the state of North Carolina. In 2008, North Carolina had gone for Obama. They didn't like what Obama was doing after 2 years. And so in 2010, all of the state offices went Republican. Of course, the congressional seats didn't change because those are picked in advance by the gerrymandering. But then that did change because with a new legislature and at the state level, they changed the districting in 2010. So then the Republicans got control of the congressional seats there. So this is how that goes. So I guess we should ask Punxsutawney Phil what's going to happen in November with the election. Just as likely he'd know that as he knows the weather. The definition of domestic terrorism. A Fox News analyst pushes Trump to invoke the Insurrection Act against anti-ICE radicals, quote unquote. And this has now become a standard line for the women of Fox News, the nanny state girls. They want an insurrection act. They want to kick off a civil war. They think they're going to skate right above it. Maybe they will. This is not warranted. It wasn't warranted with all the talk about an insurrection on January the 6th, of course. How soon they forget. And they don't realize what they are setting up in terms of a precedent. So you had Fox News political analyst Lisa Booth. So it's time for Trump to invoke the Insurrection Act because the anti-ICE, quote-unquote, radicals are violently attempting to subvert federal immigration law following the deaths of Renee Good and Alex Pretty. So she was joined with other commentators there. They said, because these individuals, these radicals, are using violence to try to change government policy, that is the definition of domestic terrorism. Well, yes, you know, if you use the threat of force or violence, or terroristic acts to alter the political landscape, that's terrorism. Seems to me that same definition could apply to ICE and the Trump administration. That's really what they're doing. You want to go out there with masks and start attacking people? But of course, that never applies to the government, does it? We're going to talk about some of the effective ways that they've organized against this. And whether or not you agree with their goal, we need to always pay attention to the tactics. You know, there's, as I said before, the end does not justify the means in many cases. But sometimes, even if you don't agree with the end goal, you can learn something about the means that people are applying to this. So we're going to talk about that coming up. So you had Anita Vogel also agreed with Booth's take, and we had Tommy Lahren pushing war as well. You had three women, all of them want war. Reminds me of one of my favorite musicals, I guess I put in that category, Pirates of Penzance. The women get out there and go, ye heroes, go and die. You're pushing the guys on to war, and it's like, oh, wait a minute, I don't know where we want to go. That's what this has become. This is a chorus of go, ye heroes, go and die. Let's have a civil war. That's Fox News for you. Vogel said the protesters are fixated on helping illegal immigrants while displaying a lack of compassion for the families of people killed by illegal immigrants. Are you kidding me? You want to talk about a lack of compassion around killing and you want to completely ignore ICE? What a pathetic parody Fox has become, if ever it was anything other than that. It's just amazing. It's bad or worse than CNN. Authoritarian women like this on the left, the nanny staters, right? So we got authoritarian women on the left, authoritarian women on the right. I'm stuck in the middle with you. They all want war. Well, they're about to get it with Iran, I think. The U.S. military was working with a key Middle East ally to try to get them to cooperate. Maybe that's one of the reasons why this got delayed. It was interesting that Iran did live ammunition drills close to where the U.S. military was. I think they really expected it this last weekend. So Trump is going to tamp down expectations and then do a sneak attack. I'm sure that's the way this will happen. So this isn't about nukes or about the missile program. This is about regime change, said a former senior U.S. intelligence official who consults for Arab governments and is an informal advisor to the Trump administration. Remember when Trump said he was going to be the peace guy? He's all about peace, isn't he? He wants the Nobel Peace Prize. He's got a board of peace. But I think he's really bored of peace, B-O-R-E-D. And I think he wants more wars. He's been one of the most in-your-face people about it. Many times they'll try to come up with a pretense that is somewhat plausible to start the wars, even if they're the aggressors, but not with Trump. He just does it and dares you to stop him, like everything else he does. DropSite News has told the U.S. war planners envision attacks that target nuclear, ballistic, and other military sites around Iran, but will also aim to decapitate the Iranian government. In particular, leadership and capabilities of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. The thinking in the Trump administration, according to the source, is that a successful strike on Iranian leadership would be followed by Iranians returning to the streets to protest. Netanyahu is hoping for an attack, said the former senior intelligence official, and assuring Trump that Israel can help put in place a new government that is friendly to the West. How'd that work out last time we did that in the 50s? Who wound up with the Ayatollah. We haven't done too well with regime change, and Iran is one of the premier examples of our failure in terms of regime change. They took out Mossadegh, who was elected in the, what was it, 52, I think, and they put in the Shah of Iran, who was a totalitarian bully, and that's how they wound up with this radical Islamic regime. It spun back in the other direction. But most Americans don't really realize that we did that regime change back in the 1950s. On Friday, Iran's foreign, and of course, the crime of the guy that we removed, was to say that the oil belonged to Iranians rather than the Western oil companies, and so he was going to take more control of it. It was all about the oil, like in Venezuela. On Friday, Iran's foreign minister met with Turkish leaders to push forward a possible diplomatic solution. Regional countries have been engaged in attempts to establish a format for back-channel talks, including a trilateral meeting involving Iranian, American, and Turkish leaders. The problem is that you've got people like Lindsey Graham and many people in the Trump administration, who Lindsey is out there on a one-man mission to get us involved in a war on the side of the Kurds. He's got his ways. Kurds and ways. Anyway, Lindsey Graham never saw war anywhere that he didn't want to get involved in. And so now he wants to get us involved with the attacks on the Kurds. And of course, what happened with the Kurds, if you remember in the Bible, you have the Persians, you have the Babylonians, and you had the Medes, right? The Medes, Persians, and the Babylonians. Well, they didn't, when they split up the Middle East after World War II, the British especially, they didn't give the Medes a homeland. Instead, what they did was they basically gave the Persians Iran, the Babylonians Iraq, and the Medes were left straddled in this area being attacked by both of them. And so their territory straddles both of these nations, and they're in constant conflict with people there. And so Lindsey Graham sees that conflict, and he wants to get American troops involved. Saudi Arabia on Tuesday ruled out the use of its airspace for a potential U.S. attack on Iran with a phone call with Mohammed bin Salman. This guy's got more on his plate than he can handle. He's really upset because he's got to shut down this line. Remember that thing he's going to spend? I forget what the amount was, the price tag. It was unbelievable. And it was this massive smart city out in the middle of the desert. It was a boondoggle from the beginning. We were laughing at it from the beginning. And back in 2024, they scaled it back from hundreds of miles to 1 mile. And now even that looks like it's going to be shut down. So he's got other issues on his mind there. But he doesn't want to get involved with the war right now. The UAE also said on Monday that it would not allow its airspace or territorial waters to be used in any military action against Iran. So they're having trouble getting the Arabs to join with the Americans on an Israeli war. That's really what this is. So we're told that, of course, they thought it was going to unfold over the weekend. But the Iranian people are saying this isn't going to go the way Trump imagines. Carrying out a quick operation and 2 hours later tweeting that the operation is over. They said, from the Zionist regime to countries that host American military bases, all will be within range of our missiles and drones. And they point out that they had gone out of their way to telegraph what they're going to do when they did retaliatory attacks as kind of a face-saving measure. Iranian officials repeatedly said if the U.S. attacks Iran, particularly if it aims to assassinate the country's leadership, it will respond with unprecedented counterstrikes against U.S. military facilities, oil infrastructures in the region, and Israel. And so you might wind up seeing a major catastrophe in terms of the oil industry. And of course, Venezuela is not going to come online anytime soon. Since the Gaza war began October 23, the Iranians have mostly executed restraint in response to attacks that have been launched by both Israel and the United States. They've chosen to telegraph in advance attacks in order to minimize escalation. Before launching retaliatory strikes following previous Israeli attacks, like the assassination of Hamas's political leader in July 2024, Tehran communicated through back channels to the U.S. that it would be launching a barrage of missiles and drones at Israel, thereby avoiding large-scale casualties and escalation in fighting. And so the people in Iran, some of them were saying, professor at the University of Tehran told DropSite that in the past, a number of high-ranking military officials made the decision to inform the U.S. when they were attacking U.S. bases. That idea was basically trying to ride out the Trump administration and not to confront him in a serious manner. To respond to him, but to respond in a very limited way so they don't start a huge war with the U.S. He said that the new leadership of the military in Iran has determined that the previous policy failed to deter U.S. and Israeli aggression. So the numbers that I hear is the goal is to kill at least 500 American soldiers. The casualties they need to have if Iran is attacked again is at least 500. I think the Iranian government, the Iranian military, has decided to respond quite harshly this time because you cannot have a country when that country is threatened to be attacked militarily every other week. The revelation that the U.S. has informed the leadership of regional allies that strikes on Iran could begin immediately comes amid ongoing efforts to mediate a last-minute off-ramp to a war. So did that work, or is the strike still on? Too soon to tell. But, you know, when we look at this, I think many times about Flight 800, the U.S. flight that was shot down off of Long Island, I believe, as part of a Navy drill. I think it was accidental, but, of course, the FBI covered that up. They went around and confiscated records from people. Similar thing had already happened a couple of years prior to that. The U.S. was conducting military drills, and they accidentally shot down an Iranian civilian airliner, killed over 200 people. Now, they admitted it. The Iranians had the evidence, unlike in America, where if you got the evidence, the FBI comes around and confiscates it from you and threatens you, right? So they had the evidence, and it was pretty clear that was what had happened. And yet they didn't attack. Instead, they accepted monetary compensation for the families, which was actually pretty minor. It is, you know, they have the constant death to Israel, death to America chants that they do all the time. That is largely for domestic consumption. The sense that these limited strikes where they give advance notice, that is also for domestic consumption. But I think that they realize they don't really want to have a full-on war. However, if pushed against the wall, they have quite a few missiles, as they showed in that 12-day war with Israel. They also have access to the hypersonic missiles of China and Russia as well. So Iranians were sealing their windows and storing food and water as they prepared for an attack. However, we think here in the United States, we don't ever have to prepare for anything. Not for war. We're never going to come to our shores, right? Well, it's very easy for that to happen now with the complicated infrastructure we've got. Look at how many times our infrastructure has gone down. Whether or not that is a cyber attack from somebody or whether that's just the complexity of the infrastructure that keeps getting more and more complex, more and more fragile. It's hard to tell which one it is from where we all sit. But the reality is that it is very complex. It does fail all the time. It's just like software that we have and the technological devices that we have. They're getting worse and worse if you look at the updates. As Cory Doctorow calls it, enshittification. And that really is what is happening to technology all the time and our infrastructure as well. Does it need a little bit of help from some people who could sneak across the border and take out massive transformers for which there is no inventory? You'd have to wait a very long time to replace some of these things. We have such an amazingly vulnerable infrastructure. It just surprises me how we're going around trying to pick a fight. But of course, all the Western leaders are doing that right now. Why are they doing that? Because they already picked a fight with their own people over the immigration issues, trying to wipe out their own domestic cultures, trying to take the jobs of everyone, replace everyone, and put us in a police surveillance state using artificial intelligence. And so they know that what they're doing, and they know that when people figure that out, they're going to start to come for them. That's the other aspect of the Artelect War that Hugo de Garis was talking about. Not just coming after the technological elites, but coming after the political elites that are using this technology weaponized against us. So in Iran, as I said, as night fell, there was a tense sense of dread that fell over people at home and abroad. Rumors of an imminent U.S. military strike took hold across Iran. I kept waiting for it to hit. I couldn't sleep until morning. I was waking up and straining to hear any sound of explosions. Let's see what happens tonight, said one guy, a 43-year-old engineer living in Tehran. And I mention this because I know there's going to be some people out there, if they hear this, they're going to, good, I hate those Iranians. You're going to find these chickens come home to roost in America at some point in time. I'm just mentioning this because it's like, do you really want to run the risk that we're going to have some kind of a war like this actually come to us? I think the chances of that happening are really high. It's eventually going to happen.
The whole blowback thing of, you think these people that couldn't sleep all night because they're waiting for America to bomb them are going to have any positive feelings toward the U.S.?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. How much more hatred can we gin up across the world? I mean, Trump's even got the Canadians hating us. He's never had any problem with that before. One person who opposes a foreign attack in Iran said, people seem to be losing their minds. There's that kind of thinking in Iran, too. They think that if the U.S. strikes, everything will be fine. because the killings committed by the Islamic Republic, people are becoming desperate. They no longer know what is in their interest and what is against them. You see, even if you're living in a repressive regime, and it is a repressive regime, make no doubt about it, but even if you live in something like that where they've killed, they admit that they've killed over 3,000 people. Others are saying, well, it's more like 6,000, and almost all protesters that are there. So when you see something like that happening, a lot of the people are saying, well, it'd be better if we have a war, because then we get to overthrow this regime. They don't understand how war is going to affect them. According to government sources, 3,117 people, mostly security forces, were killed in the crackdown. Because it's only the security forces that count, right? However, human rights groups outside of Iran believe the number is much higher, with some putting it at more than 6,500 people, the majority of them civilians. And so, as many people are making their preparations, sealing the window, stocking up food, they said, when the bombs drop, there's not going to be any distinction between the regime and the opposition. In other words, they're going to be dropping bombs on everybody. And that's one of the things that I think is a miscalculation in terms of bombing countries, thinking that you're going to change their mind about something. It only galvanizes them. And so, when the Americans start raining death and the Israelis start raining death from the skies on these people, it's going to consolidate support for this oppressive Iranian regime. No matter how bad the regime is, people are going to go to it because they see it as a means of stopping this. We've always seen this with civilian bombing campaigns. But of course, we don't make the distinction between civilians and people in the military anymore, not since World War II.
There are some interesting parallels between this and ICE,
yeah,
in that they aren't going to, you know, the whole thing of when the bombs fall, there won't be any difference between the regime and the opposition. When the police state comes, they're going to be coming for the citizens as well.
That's right.
They're everybody. Using the immigrants, the illegal immigrants, as a excuse.
And I just say to Tommy Lauren and this Booth person and the other one, I forget what her name was, when a civil war happens, there's not going to be all your political tribalism and what you're telling people in order to get your cushy job. That's all out the window. So when the war begins, they said, when is it going to be in? Social media, which became accessible again after a 3-week internet blackout during the crackdown on protests, is now filled with advice on how to survive missile attacks and bombs. The list of precautions is long. Stock enough food and water for 10 days. Keep a first aid kit within reach. Place ID and essential documents in a quick bag for quick evacuation. Keep emergency exits clear. Move to open spaces at the sound of an explosion. Lie on the ground next to a wall. Dozens of similar tips circulating on Persian language platforms. And again, war is a horrible thing. As one leftist activist is there, said, I've opposed the theocratic rulers since the 1979 revolution when the Ayatollah came in. He said, this regime has executed my closest comrades after the revolution and is now killing our children. I have no sympathy for it, but I also hate war. War will destroy everything left for us. That's exactly right. I wish Americans could understand that and think that way. But of course, they're having trouble getting their fellow citizens there in Iran to understand that as well. Our lives and our deaths have become entertainment, said one of them, a game for others. That really does sum up what's going on in Washington, doesn't it? With Lindsey Graham and Donald Trump and these other warmongers, disgust me. It's a game of entertainment for War Pete. You know, he's the guy that bothers me the most because he's so vocal about being a Christian and wearing that on his sleeve or his tattoos. And yet he is one of the most vocal people in terms of pushing for mass murder, lethality. And what they did in Venezuela was inexcusable. It was a war crime. It was murder. And so he says, what a miserable people we are, said one of them. Our rulers massacre people in the streets. And you got the Shah Jr. has become the face of the opposition abroad. And our enemy is a fool like Donald Trump. Like a common cause with this guy or woman who said this. That's just like America, isn't it? And so let's talk about our common cause and what we have. There's an interesting article on The Atlantic talking about Emin Bundy. Emin Bundy is all alone, they said. The anti-government militia leader can't make sense of his allies' support for ICE violence. See, Emin Bundy is, Emin Bundy and I are really on the same page with this. And we are totally ostracized by most conservatives out there. That's what they're talking about. Emin Bundy, after the Bundy Ranch standoff, of course, he had the fiasco in Malheur. And I've had several interviews with Emin Bundy, but it's always been difficult to get him to talk to me because he's been taken captive by some people who use him to get popularity. And I'm talking about Pete Sendilli in particular. It was very difficult to go there and get interviews with Emin Bundy because Pete Santilli was always trying to stop that. And he's somebody who, I remember when we were at the Bundy Ranch standoff, one day we were driving in, Josh and I, he was the guy who was running the camera, and we were driving in, and he had Roy, I can't remember his name, Roy, was it Roy Cooper? Anyway, that's the guy in North Carolina. I'm sorry, having a senior moment here. But Roy Potter, I think eventually it comes. Roy Potter was there, and he was yelling and screaming at Pete Santilli. I thought, what in the world is going on? We drove past him, saw them yelling and screaming. Later on, Roy Potter came to me, and he said, do you know what he did? It was the day before we got there. He said, it was this caravan of cars, and Pete Santilli was in the front. And he said, he stopped the car, and he got out, and he grabbed his camera, knowing that there's going to be a confrontation, started filming, because, but he set up the confrontation, essentially. That's what Roy Potter was saying. And he had gone to the guy who was in charge, Love was his name, the guy who was in charge of BLM in Nevada. And this guy, I used to refer to him as the Ministry of Love, because this guy just wanted to have conflict, and he was doing everything he could to escalate the situation. As a matter of fact, his counterpart in Arizona had criticized Love. He said, I went to one of these meetings, and it was ridiculous what he was doing. Everything he did was designed to increase the conflict and the likelihood of a conflict. This is what you see happening in Minnesota as well. And so the BLM, his counterpart, in Arizona, disagreed with what he was doing, and you had a lot of people in BLM that disagreed with what Love was doing. And as a matter of fact, one of them was responsible for stopping these political persecutions, not prosecutions, persecutions. You had a BLM whistleblower whose information caused a complete reversal of this. The judge was railroading people left and right, sending them to jail. And once this person put out, said, this is what really happened as a BLM agent, then the judge shut down the trial of the Bundys with prejudice, meaning they couldn't come back after them again. And so there was a difference within the government. You had some good people who were there, and you had some people who were real provocateurs. You had provocateurs on the other side as well, like Pete Santilli. And so, you know, there was bad blood with Pete Santilli and Alex Jones. Now they have made common cause, which I think is kind of interesting. Now that Alex has changed, the two of them are buddies. So after this standoff, Emin Bundy went to the Malheur thing. And they wanted to help these ranchers that are being railroaded up there, but the ranchers didn't want help. They wanted to just go to jail. I mean, it's one of the craziest things. And it really was a horrific thing they did to that family. And that was the BLM that was up there as well. But I was concerned about that from the very beginning, because a couple of days before that started, you had Pete Santilli arrested, I think it was in Ohio, over a weapons charge. And there was a lot of information about that in the news. And then and there were several aspects of that weapons charge. And the next day, you know, they just let him go and drop all the charges. And he goes straight to this protest at the Malheur thing. I thought that was very suspicious. I still think it's very suspicious. And when Travis and Joe Biggs went to cover that initially up at Malheur, he did everything he could to keep them away at that point as well. And so it's kind of interesting to see, and I've had difficulty talking to Emin Bundy because, like I said, you know, he's been, you know, these people don't like me, and, you know, oh, you know, don't talk to David Knight, he's a Fed. It's like, I didn't set them up. I didn't record this stuff and let it go like Pete Santilli did. Anyway, not long ago, says the Atlantic, Ammon Bundy was the most famous right-wing militia leader in America. His two armed standoffs had made him the face of the Patriot Movement, a loose assemblage of anti-government extremists, Second Amendment maximalists, and more than a few white nationalists. Even some mainstream elements of the Republican Party embraced him as a modern folk hero. But Bundy's criticism of the Trump administration's immigration crackdown now threatens to make him a pariah within his own community. In November, Bundy self-published a long essay titled The Stranger, in which he labeled the Trump administration's treatment of undocumented immigrants a moral failure. To call such people criminals for lacking official permission to be in the country, he said, is to forget the moral law of God, the historical truth of our founding, and the constitutional ideals that continue to define justice. Bundy told his audience that ICE's conduct clearly looks like tyranny, quote unquote. If the government threatened his family, he said, he would fight back by whatever means necessary. Now, I am not for open borders, and I have, this has been one of my departures of the Libertarian Party from the very beginning. I always put a footnote on that. They would have 10 questions about civil liberties issues, 10 questions about economics. And the one question out of 20 that I had a difference with him on was on immigration. I said, you got to stop the welfare state first. And then we can talk about having open borders. If you don't have any welfare state, I'm fine with open borders. But the other aspect of it is that if they violated your immigration law, they shouldn't be treated just for that one thing as if they are a murderer and a rapist. And this is why the Trump administration knows that, and they pretend that they're only rounding up people who are rapists and murderers. Question is, why are known rapists and murderers wandering around in America loose? Well, it's because we have a broken justice system that sets them loose. And so the real criminals are being set loose, and they're treating people who basically broke the law, but it's like a misdemeanor. They're treating them as if they were rapists when they let the rapists go and the murderers go. That's what's really happening, folks. And it's a deliberate policy because they want to create conflict, just like Love did in the Bundy Ranch standoff.
It's anyway. Like if you had different police forces for every different type of crime. So you arrest some guy for breaking and entering. Oh, there's a warrant for assault. Well, let him go, and we'll inform the assault police that we let him go. That's right. Patently absurd, and yet it's presented as though the only way to stop immigration is through this ridiculous authoritarian ICE thing. I saw a great tweet that was, I love how we've set this up so that you're either on team unlimited immigration, unlimited Somalis, or team police state.
That's right. Yeah, I'm not either one of those teams. It's this person in the Atlantic said, I spoke with Bundy a few hours after the federal immigration agents shot and killed Alex Preddy. He said to me on the phone, he said, it's sickening just to see the parallels of history repeating itself. His November essay, he had compared the administration's treatment of immigrants to the internment of Japanese Americans during World War II. He said, when it comes to the more humanitarian side of it, I think the left has it much more correct than the nationalist right, he said. Bundy, to be clear, has not gone woke. And this is the other thing to me. You know, it's like how that word has been co-opted and altered and applied as a pejorative to anybody that disagrees with the so-called conservatives. And I call them, they're worse than neocons. They're Trump cons. He believes that Democrats, who he calls communist anarchists, are spurred by wickedness. So, he says, are Republicans, whom he calls nationalists. He believes the government has no business providing virtually any social services. He believes that homosexuality is a sin, and I don't ask him about vaccination requirements. And, of course, I know where he is on that as well. He and I are exactly aligned on all the issues that I know that he's publicly spoken about. And when it comes to vaccination stuff, when it comes to COVID stuff, in Idaho, he was a leader of the resistance there because things are pretty bad in Idaho with the Republican governor, Brad Little, acting like a dictator, even dismissing the Republican legislature when they came together, were going to come together for a special session to shut it down. It's because Brad Little, like most of these Republican governors and Democrat governors, were getting massive amounts of money from the Trump administration. They were getting money that was bigger than the state budget, all under their individual control. So it wasn't just bribery and blackmail, financial bribery, financial blackmail, but it was also Trump giving massive amounts of money to governors, and they knew what they could do with that money. It's like, you know, here's some of my dictatorial power. I'm going to share it with you. And they did it that way. And so I thought it was very interesting that in response to medical kidnapping in hospitals, both with COVID and otherwise, he organized a group to call people. It's called, I think, the People's Network, something like that. I thought that was a great idea. I covered that. I interviewed him on that. And I thought it was an excellent idea. It was decentralized. We're going to talk about that next from a left perspective, what is happening in Minnesota. I think that was a very effective idea in terms of implementation. However, it fell very flat. I signed up for it, put my name there publicly that I would sign up for it. And I could never get any information from anybody other than Ammon about what was happening. I don't know if nobody else signed up for it in Texas or what. But I thought it was a very effective way. Basically, it was going to be a way to alert people as to what was happening. Same thing that you see happening in Minnesota, where they have networks and they have phone numbers and they call other people and they show up in mass to protest something. If somebody's kidnapped at a hospital, for example, and you know, because you didn't want to get their vaccines, they're not going to let you take your kid home or something like that. You could show up in mass and get public attention to it. Sometimes you could get the hospital to release them as well. So it was a very effective thing, but I put my name in it, and nobody ever contacted me, and I could never find anybody to contact. So I was like, okay, well, don't know what's going on with it. But that's the right idea. Perhaps Bundy's central belief is the inviolability of individual liberty. And he's also very strong in the Constitution as well. And in this, he has remained fairly consistent over the years. During the first Trump presidency, he took heat from some of his followers for opposing the administration's anti-immigration agenda. And when I first spoke with him a few years ago, says the writer of this Atlantic piece, he iterated those views. If he has become something of an outcast, that testifies less to a transformation in his thinking than to a broader realignment of the far right. Bundy, in his relative ideological fixity, offers a stable reference point against which to measure the shift of the right due to the influence of Trump. They've been captured, right? They've been captured by these tribes. In 2014, Bundy and his father, Cliven, part of that Bundy standoff there, and they were avatars of a conservative belief in the importance of individual liberty and the righteousness of resistance, even armed resistance if necessary, to government tyranny. In a Fox News poll asking thousands of viewers whether they were Team Cliven Bundy or Team Federal Government, 97% answered Team Cliven. Several Republican U.S. senators publicly defended the family. Sean Hannity repeatedly had Cliven on his show. As a matter of fact, that's another story. I got there and we started covering it, and then CNN shows up, and Fox News shows up, and I go to interview Cliven, and he says, well, we can't do an interview here because we agreed to give Sean Hannity an exclusive on it. And I said, okay, well, how about if you just let me shoot you with the trees behind you? He won't know where these trees are. You know, he doesn't know that we're doing it at your house. And so he agreed to do that. And, that's, again, it's like Pete Santilli. They go and they try to get exclusives with people. And that's the thing that always makes it more difficult to be able to talk to people when you get out there. 2 years later, Ammon led a six-week occupation of the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge that left with the death of Lavoie Finicum. They characterize it here in the Atlantic as one rancher dead, shot down by police officers after a backwoods car chase. That's not what happened at all. That is not at all what happened. He was ambushed. And as a matter of fact, where were they going in that car when they started, they pulled over and they had snipers shooting into the car, the people that were there. And Cliven, Lavoie Finicum got out with his hands up in order to save the other people that were in the car. They shot him in the back. As I saw it, there was another one of these Randy Weaver, Branch Davidian type of things. They were on their way to a community meeting. They were out there explaining to people what the BLM was up to in various states. And there was a sheriff in the county that was going to be leading that meeting. They were not lawless radicals out there fighting the government in every way. They were appealing to the lesser magistrate, is what they were really doing when they murdered Lavoie Finicum. From 2022 to 2023, Ammon was embroiled in a slow-motion standoff with local and state law enforcement in Idaho, stemming from his refusal to pay a $52 million judgment against him in a high-profile defamation case. And that I don't know anything about, because I've lost track with him at that point. I reached out to a number of those who'd stood with Bundy at Bunkerville, at Malheur, and afterward. None of them would condemn ICE, and some expressed enthusiastic support, says the Atlantic here, this writer. When I asked Nick Ramlow, a Montana militia member of Bundy's People's Rights Network, that's what it's called, People's Rights Network, about Good's killing, he referred me to a recent Supreme Court opinion and stressed, quote, a jury will make a determination of liability when a civil suit is brought, unquote. In other words, Ramlow, who once told a sheriff that he, quote, better keep his nose clean, unquote, because Ramlow had a bigger army than he does, didn't want to comment one way or the other until the courts weighed in. Well, of course, we know the federal government is not going to police its own. And so if there's any justice at all, it'll be in a civil lawsuit. But I think that's a pretty pathetic approach to that. Eric Parker, who in 2014 made a name for himself by training a semi-automatic rifle on federal agents at the Bundy Ranch, and who is now the head of the Real Three Percenters of Idaho, had nothing but praise for the agent who killed Good. Isn't that amazing? This is what I said, the blindness from the people that were there on January the 6th, and now the blindness from the people that were there at the Bundy Ranch standoff. What is the matter with them? I don't get it. He said, I mostly think it's important to note how impressive it was to get those first two shots off in under a second. So it's great that he was able to get a couple of shots off and very quickly to murder a woman who was driving away and was not a threat to him. And to make her a threat to anybody who was on the road ahead of her. Because now you got a dead person behind the wheel of a car. That is against police procedure, as well as Homeland Security procedure. Lee Rice, a longtime People's Rights member, a steadfast Bundy supporter, who participated in the Oregon standoff, told me when I first met him in 2023, he didn't, quote, believe in the government running roughshod over you, unquote. But when I spoke to him recently about ICE's tactics in Minnesota, he said, quote, I'm supportive of what's going on, because we need to get those clowns out of here, unquote. Which clowns would those be? You mean the Somalis that nobody paid any attention to in the first Trump administration, or even in the second Trump administration, until you had that report that went viral? And then somehow they discovered that these people were there. And as I said before, this is a problem of fraud and corruption, most likely fraud and corruption of the mayor and the governor there, the governor of Minnesota. And so you go after Fry, and you go after Walls, and you go after them with accountants and lawyers. You don't go door to door trying to create conflict. This is what Love did at Bundy Ranch, and this is what Trump is doing. Same thing that's happening. And these people are completely blind to it. Makes me so angry when I see this. Good deserved what she got, he said, because she had sided with undocumented immigrants. I've seen this attitude over and over again, so much so, on Twitter, I'd hope that it was bots that were out there. Unfortunately, it's people who think like bots. On the whole, Bundy's former allies seem to remain solidly in favor of masked, armed federal agents. Just the other day, Bundy told me he had a contentious conversation with a militant who had joined him at Malheur. Bundy had always thought that he and his supporters stood for a coherent set of Christian libertarian principles that had united them against federal power. He said, we agreed that there's certain rights that people have that they're born with, and everybody has them equally, not just in the United States, but on this topic, they're willing to completely abandon that principle. And folks, when you do that, you give a free pass to the government to violate every bit of the Constitution and the Bill of Rights if somebody is foreign in your country. Guess what? When they get used to doing that, it feels good to law enforcement not to have to be encumbered by the law, by the chains of the Constitution. And they're going to start doing that to you as well. And, you know, when we look at the way we conduct war and how we start wars, how we target civilian populations, what is that about? That's about not understanding that we're all created in the image of God. And it's a complete rejection of both Christian and libertarian principles. He said, we agreed there's certain rights that you're born with, but these people are completely willing to abandon that principle, abandon all their principles, quite frankly. He finds this ideological betrayal totally baffling. He would start to say something and he'd say, I can't understand how much they think, and then he'd just break it off. He says, it just doesn't make sense to me, he finally said. It's scary, actually. I think it is as well. I'm more afraid of a polarized people in a country who want to kill each other, these two tribes that they've created that want to kill each other, and anybody else who gets in the way that's not a part of their tribe. I'm more concerned about that even than an out-of-control government. Like I said before, you know, the drug cartels and everything, which are created by our failed drug war. But they, as dangerous as they are, and they are dangerous, they're not as dangerous as a gang that comes out of the federal government that kills with impunity. They don't have to watch their back to be prosecuted. There's no police coming for them. They are the police. That's the most dangerous situation that you can have. But when you create a population that wants to kill each other, and this is being stoked by everybody from Fox News to Alex Jones. So Ammon Bundy is politically adrift. He certainly sees no home for himself on the communist anarchist left, nor does he identify anymore with the nationalist right and its authoritarian tendencies. The people who supported him have, by and large, left him behind. He feels, he told me, a little bit alone. Yeah, politically homeless. That was the term that we always used as libertarians. You know, are you politically homeless? Take our quiz. Maybe if you don't like the Republicans and Democrats, maybe you would like the approach that we're taking. But the libertarians have abandoned their principles as well. I saw them throw that all out the window in 2020 as the government was locking us down with COVID. You had the presidential campaign that would be run by Jo Jorgensen, who I know pretty well. I couldn't believe what she was doing. The only libertarian who was running for office that stood up and said anything about it was Donald Rainwater, who was running for governor in Indiana. All the rest of them did absolutely nothing. They just said, go along with whatever the government is doing. So yeah, Ammon Bundy feels alone. So do I. It truly is amazing. Well, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about the tactics. This is something from the Free Thought Project. It's actually an article from the Center for a Stateless Society. And he's a leftist anarchist, and he's talking about what's going on in Minneapolis. And I think what is really not appreciated by conservatives is they think that there's always some kind of top-down organized structure. And that's what he's talking about here, networks versus hierarchies. You know, what is happening there is a network. And, of course, all the people who are trying to make excuses for this say, oh, well, that's all being organized by George Soros. There is some money from Soros that's coming in there, but the point of networks versus hierarchies is that there isn't any leader there. That's what everybody was saying about Antifa, for example. I don't agree with Antifa at all. I think they're very dangerous. However, if you look at their strategies of decentralization and of networking versus a hierarchy, you know, they don't have a hierarchy, which is why all of these reports that are coming, not all of them, but the majority, the knee-jerk reaction with all this stuff is, let's find out where Soros is inserting money into this. He is not at the top of the food chain for all that. He provides a lot of money for it. But these people are organizing on their own, and we'll talk about that when we come back. We're going to take a quick break, and we will be right back. Stay with us. Thank you.
using free speech to free minds. It's the David Knight Show.
Tell Alexa to add the APS radio skill and have access to the best channels anywhere, from country to blues, classic hits to news. APS radio curates incredibly diverse playlists for you to enjoy. Get details at APSradio.com.
All right, welcome back. I'm going to take some of the comments that are here. And Star Barkley, thank you very much for the tip. And I should have mentioned this earlier. I wanted to thank everybody. We made our goal for the month, which is really surprising. A lot of it came in at the very last minute. And so thank you so much to everybody who supported us. And by the way, Ryan has sent us some of the medallion coins. So we're going to bring those back out again. They went out pretty quickly. And there was only 100 of them, I think, the first time. So we're going to be putting those back on the website. So thank you so much for the support, everyone. We really do appreciate it. Happy Groundhog Day, says Star Barkley. The Epstein revelations are heating up with the Rothschilds chick and her emails to Epstein and Ukraine. Thanks for all you do. Yeah, I saw another connection with the Rothschilds, and that was Steve Bannon took advantage of this to release, what was it, about an hour of the many, many hours of interviews that he had with Epstein. He was going to be the PR guy for Epstein. Just think about it. Why is he the darling of the right? Why is Steve Bannon the darling of the right? But anyway, he was asking him, you know, how he got involved in some of these things. And he starts talking about, oh, the Rothschilds did this and the Rothschilds did that. And he goes, so Steve Bannon says, wait a minute, how did you get involved with the Rothschilds? I think that's something of a rhetorical question, don't you? I mean, we pretty much understand how he got involved with them. But he was at the center of a lot of different things. In the school where he was a teacher, the headmaster was Bill Barr's father, you know. So that when you look at this stuff, it truly is amazing, you know. You see Ken Starr coming back into all this stuff and everything. It's very much like a little Dickens novel. You know, it's this little tiny, you know, click of people that just keep coming back into each other's spheres. Truly is amazing. And so we're going to talk about that. I wanted to talk about the overall news first, and I've got this other article. I want to talk about the hierarchical structure of this because, look, folks, it's not going to get fixed from the top down. It really isn't. And even if we were to get these pedophile rascals out of government, there'll be other people who will take their place who may be as bad or worse. I mean, I don't know that Stephen Miller was ever involved with Epstein. There's no indications so far that he was because he didn't have any money at the time, right? Not to say that he wouldn't be up for it at this point in time, but who knows? I have a very low esteem of Stephen Miller, Pee Wee German, but there's people like him that are still going to be there, even if these pedophiles, these billionaire pedophiles were taken out. Kuda Bing, thank you very much for the tip. I appreciate that. It says, hi, Lance. Good to hear from you. I've been listening to the show since 2015. Even on InfoWars, David has always had the voice of reason. Well, thank you. Stemming from the values of Jesus Christ, and he's never changed. Well, thank you. Appreciate that. Audi, good to see you. Audi Modern Retro Radio. Let us know how the show is going. I need to get you on and talk about your show. It's all a lie. He's absolutely right. It says the Insurrection Act was the plan all along. If there's any chaos, you can count on government to manufacture it. That's what I was saying the other day. It's like, be aware when you've got a government-manufactured problem, and the border is a Republican-Democrat manufactured problem. They would use it for election purposes, but now they're using it for police surveillance state purposes, folks. Beware when the government creates a problem and then offers you as the only solution, just like the vaccine, the only solution is a police surveillance state. It's a setup. It's exactly what it is. Whenever they create the problem, offer you a totalitarian solution, don't fall for it. Nibiru, 2029, a Democratic-controlled Congress is exactly what Democrat Caligula Trump desires to serve his dystopian rubber stamp agenda. Exactly right. Yeah, he's supposedly not a part of them, right? He's not a Democrat, just like he's not a pedophile. He's not a globalist, just like he's not a pedophile. People need to start figure out what this guy is. It's been right in your face from the very beginning, hasn't it? Especially from 2020 on. Pisano Vante, 1776, former Trump national security advisor, said the idea to acquire Greenland came from none other than Ronald Lauder. Now Ronald Lauder's son-in-law will become Fed chairman in May at the end of Powell's term upon confirmation. I think they've got a different name. I think it's Warsh. Because I was laughing about it. I said, they're going to try to whitewash all of this stuff with this new Fed chairman. We're going to whitewash the federal budget deficit. All the problems have been solved, according to the Wall Street people. And you saw what happened, I guess, over the weekend with gold and silver after Trump announced his choice for Federal Reserve Chairman, Warsh. And so I don't think they've solved anything, folks. I don't think he's doing anything as he changes the chair of the Federal Reserve. He's rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic. That's all that's really happening. And I think Trump will get his way with whoever he puts in. I don't think he's going to put in anybody that isn't going to do everything that he wants. Audi says, Audi MRR says, so Trump is basically willing to sacrifice 500 military servicemen to justify ramping up war. Yeah. Any number of people. They don't care. As a matter of fact, you know, when you look at it, this is one of the problems I always had with the people who said, well, nobody died at this event or whatever. That became a regular thing after Steve Pachinik and others sold that through Alex Jones. Well, nobody died. It serves their purpose when people die. It gets people angry. It gets people to fall in line behind them. In the same way that when you bomb a civilian population, when Hitler bombs London, what happens? Does it break the morale of the people in London? No. It galvanizes them against Hitler. And so it's the same type of thing. You want to have those casualties. You want the Japanese to attack Pearl Harbor. That's the way the Machiavellian ways these SOBs operate. Truly amazing. Solo Cat, 1980. The government creates problems, then always brings in more tyranny as a solution to that problem. Absolutely. Pisano Vante, 1776. Did you hear about the new proposed gun law in VA in Virginia, where they want to charge gun owners whose guns have been stolen with a crime? Yeah, that's. I'm sure that's going to be. There's a lot of novel approaches to it. We've seen some novel approaches from Trump himself in his first administration. Just wait for that to fall. He's been very anti-Second Amendment, and it's cost him a lot of support with Republicans. That's one of the other things that's going to be a factor, I think, in the midterm elections. But I see the elections as more selections than anything else anyway. Let's talk about what we can do. And again, this is coming from the perspective of people on the left who are pro-illegal immigration and all the rest of it. Just open the borders and flood everybody in, which I don't agree with. I don't agree with that end goal. I also don't agree with the tactics of the Trump administration and the tactics of ICE. And a lot of law enforcement don't either. You had a lot of police chiefs in Minnesota, who spoke out against that. You've had police chiefs in other areas that have spoken out against what is happening with this. And so it's important to separate the tactics from the end goals. Whether or not you agree with the end goals, even if the end goal is bad, you can learn something if the tactics are good. And if the end goal is good and the tactics are evil, that is a very dangerous precedent-setting thing. So let's take a look at this. This is a story from the Free Thought Project. And the author is coming from Center for a Stateless Society. He said, for some time I've been thinking about writing a review of Kevin Carson's book, The Desktop Regulatory State. And he said it helped to make him an anarchist back in 2016. Well, I think there is a legitimate role for government. But you got to have some legitimate people in there who are going to be held to some rules. You can't have lawless criminals and effectively run a government. It's going to be a lawless criminal government if you got people like Trump at the top. And so he says, citizens fought back in a way that is seemingly a textbook application of what Carson wrote about in that book, to the point that if a second edition is ever published, I wouldn't be surprised if it had an entire subsection that was a case study in networked resistance. For those who haven't read the book, a significant part of it is about establishing what Carson sees as the primary conflict going forward, namely a conflict between networks and hierarchies. And as I mentioned before, you know, the People's Rights Network, that's Ammon Bundy saw the same thing. And of course, he doesn't, you know, like me, he doesn't share any of the goals of the communists. But it's like, how do we keep this government in check? You know, you had at the time of the revolution, the way the people communicated with each other was, you know, writing stuff down and written notes and kind of passing them along. You had the committees of correspondence. Well, technology has changed that a little bit. And now you've got encrypted messaging systems. And the government and many of those on the right who want to support Trump see nefariousness in that. I see an opportunity in that, an opportunity to push back against a government that is out of control. I think we need to look at these different structures like jury nullification and state nullification. We need to look at these because the evil is primarily coming from Washington, regardless of whether it's Republican or Democrat or whoever it is that's in charge there. It's coming from Washington. He says, I'm not personally involved in the fight in Minnesota, but it certainly seems like Minneapolis is utilizing a network to fight against a hierarchy. He said, the movement is not leaderless, but it is leaderful, said one person. There are no few specific people who could be arrested to stop the movement. It's built out of so many interlocking networks, even if a bad actor managed to disrupt an individual piece of the network, the disruption would be minimal. The network is democratic in the sense that it is run by the people who are a part of it, rather than by some vanguard of leaders. People are listened to only when their ideas actually appeal to people. And again, this is what Ammon Bundy was trying to do, to set up a people's rights network. The basic strategy employed by people on the ground is identifying cars used by agents, following them, alerting others to their presence through the use of horns and whistles, and photographing or videotaping them when they try to accost and kidnap people on the street while getting the information of the people they seize. And so I got to say, you know, to me, when I look at this, where is the criminality in this? Okay. They want to say that filming them is a crime. They wear masks. They don't want to be filmed. I have no sympathy for that argument. The more you wear masks, the more you need to be filmed. What are you trying to hide? If you're decent and honest and law-abiding, you don't need a mask. It just tells you what these people's attitude is. But when you talk about blowing horns and whistles and things like that, have you ever been on the road and somebody flashed their brights because there's a speed trap right over the hill? I have been helped by that many times, and I've tried to do that to help other people as well. What is the harm in that? I mean, should we be chased? You've had some situations where some cops have come after people who alerted others to their presence. I support that, and I support it here for the same reasons. You need to have, who watches the watchers, right? We have to have government, they say, but because we're not angels, you need to watch the government. So who watches these people who watch us? That's us. We're the ones who watch the watchers. And that's what they hate so much. Outmaneuvering a hierarchically structured enemy with superior firepower instead of directly confronting them is nothing new. This is the bread and butter of successful guerrilla insurgencies. And I would say even like the American Revolution, Washington didn't have much success. As a matter of fact, the surrender of Cornwallis there in Yorktown was pretty much a fluke, and it would never have happened without support of the French government. All the victories that had happened in the American Revolution were done because of guerrilla type of firing. Think of Concord and Lexington, right? Where the British come to confiscate the cannons that belonged to the citizens, as well as rifles. And then they were shot at from, they didn't line up and confront them, which was the standard way that people fought wars at that point in time. It was a guerrilla war. And that was where their victories came from. And if you look at the Civil War, I think that would have been successful for the South if they would have fought it as a guerrilla war. That was basically the attitude of Nathan Bedford Forrest, and he was very successful. He fought in an unconventional way. It's like, I'm not going to fight by your rules. I'm going to fight in the type of ways that's going to win. And I think if they would have done that, they would have been successful. But
gave his cavalry sawed off shotguns instead of sabers.
That's right. That's right. And so, which I've talked about many times because of the Supreme Court ruling that said the sawed-off shotgun can be illegal as part of the FDR Firearms Act because it was never used by the military. And it's like, that's an absolute lie. It was used by cavalry during the Civil War, and it was used in trench warfare in World War I as well. So what Minneapolis leverages is real-time encrypted communications through phone apps like Signal, but also through radio networks. Such nonviolent swarming tactics, amplified by many-to-many communications technology, has been around for a while. Carson draws on the classic work of Rand think tankers and their concept of net war. They argued that advances in communication technology had enabled decentralized swarms to overwhelm more powerful, hierarchically organized targets. Networks operate by swarming their opponents like bees or like white blood cells, more like organisms than like machines. They approach stealthily and from many directions in offense. In defense, they can react like antibodies moving toward points of attack. Net war's line between offense and defense can be blurred, leaving opponents unclear about what is occurring and how to respond. And again, how did they swarm people? They swarmed them with cameras to witness what these masked mobsters from D.C. are doing. So I heartily agree with that. So it is a popular front, an actual popular front. The broad moral consensus that ICE should be fought is one of the distinctions between the networks and the hierarchies. People are intrinsically motivated to act because they believe in what they're doing, not because they're being forced, and so they can be trusted to do the right thing. It's not because they've been ordered, not because they are being paid, but because they believe they're doing the right thing. Bonds formed under pressure of negative double-digit wind chill are key to understanding what is happening in Minnesota. One person said, it's impossible to get through a Minnesota winter without help, and only sometimes does that assistance come from your neighbors. The stories about people shoveling out or snowblowing an entire block's driveway without being asked and with no compensation are true. But the real miracles, and just as common, are the times when strangers stop to help someone shovel out a car that's caught in a snowbank, or to bring out the kitty litter from their trunk and put it there for just this kind of emergency, for traction. I can't tell you one story about that happening to me. I have at least three or four. The pun is irresistible. Minnesotans have always declared common cause against ICE. They've just changed their focus to the ICE that you can't use for hockey practice. You can dismiss it as a joke until someone at a cafe gives you a spare scarf because you can't find yours. People offer assistance without hesitation, without question. I don't think I've ever heard someone dismiss thanks with just pay it back someday. It says, I don't think I've ever even heard someone say that. Just dismiss it. Just pay it back someday. There's also the technical infrastructure that powers the resistance in the form of an app like Signal. The crypto wars of the 90s, which made encryption legal for everyday people to use, and the work to build, popularize, and maintain Signal are what has enabled protesters securely to communicate in ways that frustrate the regime's surveillance attempts. And boy, are they upset about that in the EU and in Washington. They want to stop encryption. The specific structure of closed encrypted group chats means that the resistance is more resilient. So you can have somebody that breaks into that, but they're going to get into just an individual chat. And then there's going to be others that are going to be encrypted. They said this is much different than when people organize over public-facing social media. And we saw that during COVID. When people said there's going to be a protest against these COVID lockdown measures, this happened in Australia. And so we're going to all gather at such and such a place at such and such a time. Next thing you know, we've got video of the thugs in uniform showing up at this woman's house, and she's pregnant woman, and arresting her because she posted that on Facebook. That's why it's important to have encryption. It's worth talking about the broader political implications of all this. The reason people are acting this way is not because they have a formal understanding of the principles of swarming or of net war, but because they saw other people doing something that was effective that they could do themselves. The reason Minneapolis resistance has worked so well is that it consists of forms of activity that require minimal buy-in in terms of ideology. Secret police shouldn't abduct my neighbors, is what they're thinking. And resources, all you need is a phone, a whistle, or a car. And you know, when you looked at the Bundy Ranch, it was very different. You had a lot of people who were angry about what was happening there. Some of the people that I talked to that were there had been farmers in that area and Clive and Bundy and his family were the last people who had a farm in that area. The rest of them had been run out by the federal government under absurd pretenses about the desert tortoise and things like that. And actually, as Cliven pointed out, the desert tortoise had thrived with cattle there. They were able to get moisture from the cattle droppings that were there. And at the same time, the BLM had taken all these desert tortoises and, you know, tried to make this precious situation out of it. And they wound up killing hundreds of them through mismanagement. So he said, they're thriving out here in the desert with our cattle, but when the BLM takes them, they can't manage to keep them alive. But I had a lot of people that I talked to who had been neighbors in the past of the Bundys, and they had been driven out by the federal government. And they were there with a grievance. Now, the situation in the Bundy Ranch, it wasn't just horns and whistles that people had and cameras, of course. They came with guns, and it was a very touch-and-go situation. As a matter of fact, there were so many people with guns that the BLM guys who wanted to fight were outnumbered, and that's the way you stop it. You know, they were the ones who wanted to initiate a fight, and they were on the minority side with that. But the other thing about the Bundy Ranch standoff that I think was significant was they had an immediate achievable goal. And that's part of the problem with a lot of these protests that are out there. You protest something that is really big and nebulous, and there's no way that you're going to get that changed. It's just redressing your grievances, but no change is going to be coming. He had a very specific goal. I want my cattle that you stole from me, I want those back right now, or we're going to come take them. And so, you know, there's certain things about the Bundy Ranch standoff that are applicable and transferable, other things that really aren't. But those are things, I think, that made it successful.
You know, I'd never really thought about the justification for it all that much, the whole desert tortoise thing, how they take ranchers that have this working, successful ecosystem. They've got to keep these animals alive, and they want to remove all the animals except for the one animal in this ecosystem, the desert tortoise, and expect it to do better. Mm-hmm. It, you know, as you said, the plants that they're eating are getting fertilized by the cows. It's an ecosystem.
And the cow dung was a source of moisture for the desert tortoise. And where did the cows get that moisture? It was from all the water infrastructure that the farmers had put in there, because the farmers were there. His family and these other families had been there many decades, in some cases like 100 years, before the BLM was even created. And they were doing land management on their ranches and farms that were there. So again, when we look at the tactics of this, when push came to shove, the people of Minneapolis didn't wait around for a verticalist structure to form that they could resist the encroachment of institutional measures. They didn't wait for a formal organization to start strategically directing people. Although the Democratic Socialists of America are part of the resistance, they are doing it themselves. And this is the folly and the blindness of the right. They think that they are so vertically oriented, they are projecting that onto other people. And if the right really wants to change things, they need to start getting into more of a network mindset like the Democrats are. And I think they are being done a disservice by people on Fox News and InfoWars every time they say, well, what's Soros doing? There's some network here where Soros is funneling money in. Yes, there's some money that is coming into some of these people. And we saw that in a big way with the Black Lives Matter riots. But this is a bit different, what is happening here. And so, again, they freak out about George Soros, but they don't care at all about the fact that Soros's right-hand man, Scott Bessent, is now the right-hand man of Trump. Nothing to see there. Just move along, right? And now, one last thing, and then we'll get on to the Epstein stuff. Of course, that video of Alex Preddy kicking a cop matters. This is actually coming from leftist Mediaite. And I have a different way of seeing this as well. So you've probably seen this. I didn't show it. He gets very angry. He's yelling and screaming at him. He kicks the car a couple of times. Then one of the kicks even kicks out the taillight of the car. I said, you know, it's kind of interesting to see how flimsy cars are anymore. I don't think you'd do that to a 1950s chrome and metal car. But anyway, he gets into a scuffle with him. And when I saw that, my thought was, what does that tell us about Preddy? Oh, well, now Preddy is a bad guy and he deserved to be killed. No, they didn't shoot him that day. They didn't even arrest him that day. So what does that tell us? Does that tell us then that a couple weeks later, the murder of Preti is valid? It wouldn't have been valid for them to kill him that day. They could have arrested him or whatever. And if he resisted arrest, who knows what would happen? But that's not what happened. The ICE agents there on that day acted very differently than the ones a couple of weeks later. So what does that tell us? It tells us that ICE is capricious, arbitrary, and has different standards. All these agents are doing whatever they please. That's what it tells us. You've got this verticalist structure that is not structured at all, quite frankly. These guys are free to do whatever they wish. And you can see that on one day when he's much poorer behaved, and you know, could have reasonably been arrested for that, that they don't arrest him, they certainly don't kill him. Then on another day when he's just filming, they kill him. What's going on with that? What's different ICE agents? And I think it tells us everything about ICE. This is not a reflection on him that they would like to believe. As this person says, for those on the right determined to justify the events of January the 24th, when he was shot dead, this shows that this is an answer to their prayers, right? Because it gives them tribal validation. For those on the left who fetishize the disorderly destructive behavior, it was something to be hand-waved away, an irrelevant, even disgusting smear of a dead man. Well, it's neither of those, actually. This person says that they didn't come anywhere close to warranting the rest of the use of lethal force on either of those days. And to cite that as a justification for his death a week and a half later, at what appeared to be a much less charged moment, is an intellectual as well as a moral error. American citizens are entitled to make mistakes, even egregious ones, without paying the price for them with their life. And I would say, again, my take on this was different than this writer, because to me, it shows the arbitrary, capricious nature of ICE and the fact that, A, they're not trained in terms of law enforcement, so you don't shoot into a moving car if they're not, say, shooting at people. This has been a longstanding rule by many, many police departments and by the Department of Justice, by Homeland Security. However, what it shows us is that these guys are just given carte blanche to do whatever they feel like. I think that's really what is happening here. And we need to understand, folks, that the politicians at the top are not accountable. They're not going to change. All of this change should come, should be done, I think, from the bottom up. And this is where I think the horizontal networks are very important, to shine the light on this stuff. Ideally, there ought to be a trial by combat with the elites. You ought to have Trump versus Waltz. And I don't mean they go out and fight with clubs. I mean they go into a courtroom, each of them armed with lawyers and accountants. And that's where the fight needs to be had. Instead, they have got a different kind of trial by combat. And that's with their ICE agents. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back and talk about Epstein. We'll be right back.
The globalist next move. And now, the David Knight Show.
Comments here. Defy Tyrant 1776. This is all about getting Americans accustomed to seeing Gestapo thugs on the street. Maybe to get people to fully accept martial law. Well, it doesn't take much prodding, does it? I mean, we saw that with COVID lockdowns. That was medical martial law, but it was martial law. They did the best they could to get that going. It's all predictive programming, isn't it? It's all getting people accustomed to this. And of course, locking everybody down and then handing them a stimulus check as well, that was programming for universal basic income that Trump was doing. So hopefully people will see through some of this. They're starting to see through some of the vaccination stuff as well. Brian and Doug McCartney, the stormtroopers are so welcome here. Yeah, here in Tennessee. And that is what they want people to see. Yeah. You know, I haven't seen any military presence around here. Maybe they're focused in Nashville and Memphis or something like that. Those are the Democrat cities. There is such an overarching political aspect of this, tribal aspect of this. That is also a key thing to understand. Solacat 1980, Fox News website is saying Melania's new quote-unquote documentary is a success with $7 million in box office profits over the weekend. Actually, that's not profits. That's they're a long way from making a profit, as you point out. That's their gross. That's their take. But they failed to mention that it cost $40 million to make. Actually, $45 million, I think, and maybe $40 million. Anyway, the total. No, I think you're right. $40 million, and it was $35 million that they spent to advertise it. Because usually, if they got a big budget picture, they're going to spend about the same amount on PR that they do in making the film. I've got a lot to say about this Melania film. I hope we got time to get to it. I'm going to go through the Epstein stuff pretty quickly because it's not really anything that we haven't already known. I mean, there are some new revelations in there about some scoundrels like Bill Gates. And we see some deeper revelations about scandals like Andrew, the man who was formerly known as Prince. That's gotten the people in the UK very upset with him. Picture of him on all fours over a woman who appears to be unconscious on the floor. It's hard to tell with redactions that are there. But of course, the timeline of what Andrew was saying was totally false. I got him into a lot of trouble in the UK as people went back and said, well, you said that you stopped talking to him after you didn't talk to him after he got convicted. But that absolutely was not true. So they released about 3.5 million files. They have said that there's 6 million of them. And Todd Blanche, who is the Deputy Attorney General, has said, that's it. We're not going to have any more, probably. So Thomas Massie and Ro Khanna, who put together the law that has just they've thumbed their nose at, why would you think that they would comply with a law that you pass about this type of thing when they thumb their nose at the Constitution constantly? Anyway, Blanche claimed that some of the tens of thousands of additional documents were not being made public, both because of the presence of child sexual abuse material. Well, you know, they have redacted a lot of stuff. I mean, we see people that are there that are all blurred out. I don't know why that would be an issue, except that it would just be too incendiary. If you see a child that is all blurred out sitting next to Donald Trump, for example. So many of the documents made available to the public on Friday did, in fact, contain names and other sensitive information about women that Epstein abused. That's what some of the lawyers of the victims have complained about. They said, look, they redacted information about these billionaire predators, but they released the names of some of the victims. And as a matter of fact, some of them, they actually capitalized their name, all uppercase, so that you would see it that was there. So they said it was a betrayal. Yes, it is. Blanche, who previously worked as Trump's personal criminal defense attorney. I think maybe he's still in that role. This is also the guy who went to Ghislaine Maxwell and spent a great deal of time with her. And as a result of that interview and the negotiations, evidently back and forth, she got moved to Club Fed, where she's got very nice accommodations now. Well, Blanche insisted that the Justice Department did not protect Trump and its decisions about what to redact and to release. That's the amazing thing. The fact that they will lie to your face about this stuff has already come out many, many times, how they've tried to redact it. And even if that hadn't, if you don't believe those reports, you look at the first group of files that they put out, and they put it on a website where you could search it. And if you typed in Trump, it wouldn't find anything. But if you typed in Trump space, you could find it. And so obviously somebody had put something there to specifically block searches of Trump. They just did it ineptly. And so that is absolutely not true. The documents themselves contain 2,000 videos 180,000 images related to Epstein, including a large cache of commercial pornography in addition to the homemade abuse material depicting Epstein's underage victims. It appears to contain a large number of uncorroborated tips as well to authorities from members of the public about Epstein's conduct, several of which come from people who claimed in their message to have been abused by Donald Trump. And again, one of these claims that I saw about pedophile rape was hearsay. And so that is not admissible in court. So somebody said, so-and-so told me that they had been raped by Donald Trump when she was 13 years old. Well, that's not admissible. But the FBI, by the same token, the FBI did not investigate these. Over and over again, you see many of these really outrageous claims that the FBI had no response to it, that they get something that is really a horrific crime like that, and they just ignore it. That was the response over and over again.
Yeah, I saw someone had a tweet saying exactly that, that someone reposted as a meme. It's like, so I'm seeing that the FBI just gathered hundreds of documents on these criminals that obviously were committing crimes and didn't do anything. They just collected
them. That's right. Over and over again. And some of the worst crimes that were here, they just did absolutely nothing.
Got top men working on it.
To hide it. Yeah, that's right. So they said there's no index, no explanation of how or when particular documents were obtained. So the full picture is going to take quite a time for journalists to piece this together. And like I said before, this is the way they do this stuff. Typically, in the past, when I'd get information from the government, they'd just give me a big data dump of pages, you know, just pages of printed out. And, you know, where do you start with this? Where's the context? How do you get any of this stuff? And so even though these are documents that can be sealed, searched, because they're computer documents on a website, there's no context for that, any of them. It's unlikely the new material will quell the public's interest in the case or mitigate their sense that Epstein and his impunity represent a paradigmatic example of the ruling elite's personal corruption, their imperviousness to law or consequences, and their back-scratching, malignant coziness with each other. Well put. That's from The Guardian. but really, like I said at the beginning of the program, all of this QAnon stuff and the nonsense that Alex Jones was on, oh yeah, Trump's rounding up these pedophile rings and everything, Michael Flynn and everything. None of that was true. He's protecting the pedophile. He was part of the pedophile ring. And he's protecting the pedophile ring. Nothing could be further from the truth. It's exactly the opposite. And the same thing is going on with the globalists as well. So Epstein was integrated in the social life of some of the world's most powerful people, to put it mildly. Even after he was initially convicted of charges relating to child sexual abuse in 2008. As a matter of fact, it also came out not as much was kind of swamped by this release of information, but Ghislaine Maxwell was appealing her conviction because she said there's at least 29 other people that are there. I'm supposedly trafficking these, I was convicted of trafficking these people, but the ones that I trafficked them to are going free. And that's absolutely true. So Richard Branson was there. Anytime you're in the area, would love to see you, he wrote to Epstein, as long as you bring your harem. Elon Musk has previously posted on X that Epstein, quote, tried to get me to go to his island, and I refused, uppercase. But the emails show a different relationship between Musk and Epstein. In 2012, Musk wrote to Epstein with enthusiasm about the prospect of visiting the pedophile's former Caribbean island. What day and night will be the wildest party on your island? I'd like to show up. So he's actually begging Epstein to let him come to one of the parties. Now, the interesting thing is you got people who are coming to Musk's defense and saying the very fact that he was demanding that these documents be released says that he didn't do anything wrong. You think that's the case?
So
didn't Trump do the same thing?
There seems to be some confusion over it because the first email between Elon and Epstein is him asking to go to the party, and Epstein's assistant says, oh, sorry, you can't come. We're winding down the operation on the island. Mm. So people have been making these memes of Elon wanted to go, but he was refused. But after that, he did go several times.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's not Gilligan's Island either. Although they probably did have a professor and an actress and all these other people. certainly did have the billionaires there. Jay Thurston Howell was not involved at Epstein Island. He was at a different island. Scandal reveals the untrustworthiness and the mendacity of the very elites that Trump and his movement now represent, the ones that they were going to get rid of, right? So there's 5,300 plus Epstein files that mention Trump in an exhaustive analysis done by the New York Times. They did a deep dive into this. They said that they have set up a proprietary search tool. They probably got some AI that's running through this. So that's how you're going to sort through that level of documents there. They said they found more than 38,000 references to Trump, his wife, Mar-a-Lago Club in Florida, and other related words and phrases in the latest batch of emails, government files, videos, and other records released by the Justice Department. They said previous installations of the Epstein files, which the department released late last year, included another 130 files with Trump-related references. The files are peppered with references to Mr. Trump, a close friend of Epstein's until the early 2000s. And we've gone over all that kind of stuff before. But again, many unverified tips are where you find Donald Trump there. And I think one of the most interesting things is the explanation from Trump's former personal defense attorney, who is now the assistant, who's now the deputy attorney general, Todd Blanche. And he said, well, you know, you don't see Trump in there now. And because they did have several files that were up there. And people grabbed the links to them. And then later in the day, the Department of Justice purged those files. After they put them up, perhaps not understanding what was in them. And then after people started saying, look at this one, they pulled those files down. So now Todd Blanche can say, well, we don't have any files with Trump in it. We got rid of those the next day. So some of the new files are duplicates of files released last year. But in reality, pretty much, I don't see too much that is earth-shattering. I mean, we knew of Bill Gates' relationship with Epstein. There was a lot of talk about the fact that it was at the center of his divorce with Melinda Gates. What was new that came out was an email going, well, it was actually Jeffrey Epstein kind of note to self, you know, complaining to himself. And that's what a lot of this stuff is, Jeffrey Epstein writing things about people that come to his island, kind of his own email system to himself. And he was talking about how Bill Gates, with tears in his eyes, was asking him how he could give antibiotics to his wife without her knowing it, you know, surreptitiously, because he had been exposed to it and caught a sexually transmitted disease. And he was afraid she was going to get the STD. And that's about the time they got divorced.
You would think Gates would be the expert on drugging people against their will.
That's right.
Him anything about that.
We're laughing about that. Say, yo, is that when he started the mosquito stuff? I haven't heard him talk about transferring antibiotics via mosquito, but maybe that's it. We started thinking about it. So Trump's name was removed from many of these documents, and this is Jerusalem Post, as a matter of fact, taking screenshots of the Department of Justice and a page not found after there were already information that came out. And, of course, one of the most salacious things was an event they call the Calendar Girls, and I'm not going to get into the details of that. But some of the people named at these disgusting parties, so they got into what happened at some of these parties, and it truly was amazing. And these things were taken down. Some of the people named at the parties were Elon Musk, Donald Trump Jr., Ivanka Trump, Eric Trump, Alan Dershowitz, and attorney Bob Shapiro. And so it's all the usual suspects, isn't it? One Epstein survivor was really angry about the DOJ redactions, as I said earlier. The fact that they would cover up so much of this information about predators and what happened, and then not redact information about victims. And so that is also a common complaint that we're seeing here. One of the things that Epstein said in one of these emails to Larry Summers, he said, the world does not understand how dumb Trump is. This is a guy who hung out with him. They were like best friends for about 15 years or something like that. And he says, nobody understands just how dumb this guy is. Well, we're starting to get a clue, I think. Even some of his supporters are starting to get a clue about how stupid Trump is. And then there's this. Epstein's sex empire was a KGB honey trap. Let me tell you, I think this is a misdirection to steer people away from Mossad's influence there. The same thing was said about Ghislaine Maxwell's father, Robert Maxwell. He was heavily involved with Russia, the KGB. He was giving information to British service, MI5 or MI6. I can't remember which is which, but he was trading information to them. And this is something we saw from Jonathan Pollard as well. Remember when Jonathan Pollard stole these very sensitive secrets that would compromise U.S. military and U.S. military personnel's lives, that he gave that information to Israel. Israel then used that information to get Israeli prisoners out of Russian jails. And so they used it for their own purposes. So they had their back channels with the Russians as well. Robert Maxwell was seen by many to be available to anyone who would pay him. So he would work with British intelligence, he would work with Russian intelligence, but he was primarily a Mossad guy. And when he died, they gave him honors and so forth as part of that. So I think that absolutely was a part of this. And I think when you look at Jeffrey Epstein, he's somebody who's going to work with any of these disgusting spy organizations. Yes, Lance?
And the idea that if there's a connection to the KGB, then it couldn't be Mossad is ridiculous. Like, these organizations all work together, CIA, KGB, and Mossad. Like, that guy that pardoned, that Trump recently pardoned, he was getting information that he got from the U.S. government and gave to Israel that they sold to the KGB.
Yep, absolutely. And it's not just the Russian KGB, it's also Russian mafia. What they were doing, this whole thing was a honey trap. And all this information was being sold by Jeffrey Epstein to whoever was going to pay him for it. And they were anxious to get information on these billionaires in order to blackmail them, and politicians as well. So I think that is a misdirection. At the center of it is Mossad, but also you have connected the CIA, the KGB, probably British intelligence and Russian gangs as well. Now, some of the really horrific implications there of Donald Trump that were taken down. Within 20 minutes, they were gone. There were accusations, multiple accusations of rape, as well as pedophile rape. And they said, once you look at the allegations, you can see why these documents were put back under wraps. There were pedophile allegations. Like I said before, one of them was a friend told me that this happened again. That would not be admissible. You could say that was the purpose of the Department of Justice taking it down. However, when you look at the response from the FBI, the response was, we didn't do anything about it, right? Over and over again, that's the thing. So that's where the problem is. The fact that the FBI is not investigating any of these allegations, even though something that is a friend told me that this happened to someone else, a friend of theirs, that's not something that you would get an indictment for, but it's certainly something that you would hope in a better world, they would investigate, but not in this world. Another complaint tells us that at age 16, while modeling, a girl attended big orgy parties at Epstein's New York residence, Victoria's Secret models, and people like Bill Clinton and Donald Trump. And I said this all along. If you look at Trump and the Clintons, they were pals, they were buddies. He gave them money, and they partied together, all the rest of the stuff. And, of course, they have the same view of the Constitution, same view of the Second Amendment and all the rest of the stuff. Trump is a tax-and-spend Democrat when you get to the policies. But when you look at the rest of the stuff, he is as degenerate as the Clintons themselves. The complaint further claimed to have been victimized at a Trump-owned golf course in California between 1995 and 96. Excuse me. Allegations of orgies in which some girls went missing, rumored to have been murdered and buried at the facility. Complainant reported being threatened by Trump's then head of security that if she ever talked of what went on there or who she saw, she would end up as fertilizer for the back nine holes, just like the other women. Of course, he uses a much different term for the women. Then there was the alleged murder of a newborn child. One woman said she was trafficked and raped when she was 13 years old. She was pregnant in 1984. She also reported that there were high-profile individuals involved in her sex trafficking and the murder and the disposal of her newborn daughter. She reported that Trump participated regularly in paying money to force her into prostitution. Trump was present when her uncle murdered her newborn child, she said. The response from the Justice Department was, no contact made. They didn't bother to look. Another one, a victim who was a minor was drugged and wound up on a bed. When she came to, she was naked and had $300 on the bed. In 2005, Sir Ivan Wilzig hosted a party where Epstein, Sammy Sosa, and Trump were in attendance. Patti LaBelle's PR agent stood at the door at the party. The caller met an individual who was approximately 18 to 23 years of age, who was brought in from Oklahoma for a modeling job, but then sold to a man in France. Several women were being auctioned, and a woman, possibly known as Colette LNU, was the madam. And so, again, the Department of Justice response is, the phone number that was provided was bad, so we didn't follow through with anything else on this. And then the calendar girls thing, which I really can't go into any details here on the broadcast. This was a party that was at Mar-a-Lago. It's calendar girls. They were bringing in young children, and Trump was the one, kind of the MC, who would auction them off. And some of the things that they were doing to this these girls that's alleged in this is really unbelievable. But those who are present, Elon Musk, Donald Trump Jr., Ivanka Trump, Eric Trump, Alan Dershowitz, as I said before, they were there. The calendar girls thing is one of the most heinous revelations that are here. And, of course, those things have now been removed by the so-called Department of Justice. So this is, in a sense, it's not really all that different. I think it is kind of interesting that in the wake of all of this, Trump's response is to say, I'm going to sue Michael Wolff. And I've said this before. What is he going to sue Michael Wolff for? He says, well, he was colluding with Jeffrey Epstein to harm me when I was running for president in 2015. What he was said in the emails when he was talking to Epstein, what Trump is referring to, is he said, you're going to be the Achilles heel of Trump. But he goes, don't respond to this stuff. Just let him hang himself when they ask him the questions. You don't have to do anything. And so I don't see where Trump has any basis to sue him on that. What I think is interesting is the dog that did not bark. Because what Michael Wolff has said is that, and what Melania has sued other people for, threatened to sue people, billions of dollars, because Michael Wolff said that Jeffrey Epstein told him that he had brought the two of them together and that Melania was one of Jeffrey Epstein's girls. Well, she has threatened to sue people who reported what Michael Wolff said, but she didn't sue Michael Wolff. Finally, they threatened to sue Michael Wolff. He says, well, I'm not going to wait for you to sue me. I'm going to sue you for trying to intimidate me. And when Trump talked about this, he didn't talk about what Michael Wolff said about Melania. Instead, he just talked about what they said about how Jeffrey Epstein was going to be a problem for Trump because of the long friendship. So I think that is kind of interesting here. And again, Steve Bannon released some of his interviews with Jeffrey Epstein. He's got 15 hours that remain unreleased. I think what he did release was 1 or 2 hours, but he decided that he was going to capitalize on all this publicity as well. I mean, we stop and think about it. One of the people that has got their neck on the line here is a Goldman Sachs lawyer. But, you know, Steve Bannon worked for Goldman Sachs. He tried to help Jeffrey Epstein in terms of PR. How does he have any credibility with anybody? I just don't understand that at all. So I want to take a little bit of time here before I get any bogged down anymore with some of these allegations and talk about what really happened with the Melania film. Because I think that's kind of interesting as well. In terms of people that have been implicated in terms of pictures, new pictures that came out in this release, was the director of her film, Brett Ratner. And there's a picture of him in this new document. It's a woman on the couch next to Jeffrey Epstein. I think it's kind of interesting. These guys are so corrupt. They sit there, they pose with these women, many of them underage. And, you know, they're waving to the camera and all this kind of stuff at a party. And this is, you know, these pictures that have come out with this, not necessarily something that was taken with a hidden camera to blackmail them later. I mean, they're actively posing and waving to 2026. Hey, all of you in 2026, this is what I was doing 20 years ago. This guy has, he's directed some major budget films. He directed the 2006 X-Men film, which, I don't know, it had a big cast in it, but I don't know how it did in terms of box office. In terms of critics, it got like 6.6. He also did Dwayne Johnson, you know, The Rock. He did a Hercules film with him, which got a 6.0 on IMDb. So he's done a lot of films, but not a lot of good films. And he was somebody whose career basically was ended in all the Me Too stuff back in 2017. A lot of allegations of sexual misconduct. So he hadn't, this is his first rodeo since his sexual misconduct stuff. They bring him back to do Melania. How appropriate. And so what else I think is interesting about this is that 2/3 of the people who are on the credits are asking to have their names removed from the credits. And it's almost as many redactions as we've got in the Epstein documents, isn't it? I think that tells us a great deal about this. But of course, the money that it made, it's being portrayed by the right as a vindication, even though people have savaged it in terms of the critics. It was projected initially to only be about $3 million they thought it was going to do. Then, as some of the initial box office figures started coming in, they projected it up to $8 million. Turns out that it did $7 million. But again, this is, and you were right earlier, it was $40 million to make the film, another $35 million on marketing. So $75 million. And it's dying fast at the box office. I guess we could say Melania doesn't have legs. But it was. This is what Maureen Dowd had to say. The riddle of the Slovenian Sphinx has been solved. It turns out there was no riddle, no enigma, no mystery, no dark anguish. Basically, there was no there, to paraphrase Gertrude Stein, right? Added that the movie shows Melania exactly where she wants to be, in the bosom of a corrupt family that is prostituting the people's house. Dowd also said, talked about the amount of money that was there, said this is particularly gross given the fact that Amazon is engaged in mass layoffs. They've laid off 16,000 people. And he is also severely cutting back at Amazon. He's severely cutting back at the Washington Post as well. Scenes from the movie, according to Dowd, included Melania persuading Trump to declare himself a unifier. I can say that is definitely not one thing he is. He is the biggest divider I've ever seen. She seems oblivious to the fact that his rhetoric and policies are designed to enrage and to divide, said Maureen Dowd. Another scene, Melania and her son, Barron, do not want to get out of the limo during one of the inaugural parades over fears of political violence. Again, without acknowledging that her husband has been provoking violence, and we can see that now everywhere, essentially. She has a warm chat at one point about her immigrant roots with a designer who is an immigrant from Laos, ignoring that her husband has torn America apart. But you know what? This guy that ICE just kidnapped and drug out in 10-degree weather in his underwear, who had been a citizen of the U.S. since 95 and had never had any issues with the law, he was from Laos. How about that? Maybe he should be in the movie, you think? Well, again, MAGA is beating its chest and saying, this is great. 99% of the audience loves it. Can you imagine anybody going to see this thing that isn't already a dyed-in-the-wool fan of Melania? Here's the official trailer.
Here we go again.
Yeah, here we go. Yeah, that hat she wore. I was going to, any of you have seen Spy vs. Spy from Mad Magazine? I was going to put up a meme and say who wore it best.
I thought his legacy will be that of peacemaker.
Peacemaker and defier.
Yeah, well, that's all I can take of this vanity piece here. But, you know, I imagine she had a lot to say to children because she's got a lot of parental advice.
Dark? Does he wear night vision goggles that make everyone green, everything green? I bet he'd like that because Santa likes green.
She should have done Green Acres, the sequel.
Vision goggles because he might like red better.
And then, of course, she knows what our children need. They need AI.
As leaders and parents, we must manage AI's growth responsibly. During this primitive stage, it is our duty to treat AI as we would our own children, empowering, but with watchful guidance.
Yeah, yeah. Treat it as our own children. As a matter of fact, you got all the usual suspects and sycophants out there, people like Pastor Robert Jeffries of First Baptist Dallas. This is a guy who was working with Curtis Chang, if you remember. And Curtis Chang was given a large amount of money from the Trump administration to get pastors to convince people that they this is not the mark of the beast or anything preparing people for the mark of the beast. It's not harmful. You need to do this to love your neighbor, and on and on and on. Literally injecting the Kool-Aid into people. And so now he's out there praising this film and say everybody needs to go see this. So that's what they're getting, and that's going to last for about a week or whatever. But they said this best opening for a documentary. Well, they spent a lot of money to their people to get them to show up. But is it going to make a profit? Far from it. As a matter of fact, I went back and I looked at, they want to talk about the amount of box office that took in. So I thought, let's go back and look at documentaries, which that's a tremendous amount of money for a documentary. And so went back and looked over the weekend. What is the average and median budget over the last 20 years for documentaries? And what is the average and median box office for these documentaries over the last 20 years? And I thought that was very interesting because what we see is that the average budget was approximately $500,000. Of course, averages are going to be moved up if you got one big budget film that comes in. So if you look at the median budget, in other words, how many, half of them above this amount and half of them under that amount, that takes it down to $350,000. They spent $40 million, not a half a million, not a third of a million, but $40 million for this documentary. And then what do they typically make? Well, it turns out that the average budget was $500,000, and the average box office was $658,000. But if you look at the median budget, and this is over the last 20 years, averaging together documentaries, if you look at the median budget, $350,000, and they would make under $100,000. She was paid $28 million of the $40 million budget. See, that seem fishy to you? Does that seem like a box office triumph to you? You know, we didn't get to gold and silver today, and I really didn't. Let me just, let's hold it a little bit here, Lance, and let me talk a little bit about gold and silver before we end the program, because that was a big deal over the weekend. You had a tremendous sell-off, and you had gold, which for the month of January had gone up, just in the month of January, 29.5%. It went down 10% over the weekend. Silver had gone up over the month of January, 68.5%. It went down by 30%. As a matter of fact, I had somebody who was not a fan of gold and silver, and they sent that to me and said, laughing, oh, look, you know, silver is down by like 22%. Well, it's actually down by 30%. But that was just in 1 month. What is it year over year? Well, even with this big drop and sell-off over the weekend, 70% gold is still up year over year. And, of course, it is still up even over the month. I mean, if it went up nearly 30% in the month and then dropped 10%, it's still up for the month. Same thing about silver, up nearly 69% and then dropped by 30%, still up significantly in just 1 month. But gold and silver, gold year to year, up 70%, silver year to year, up 166%. You know, what is Bitcoin doing, for example? Well, month to month, Bitcoin was down 12%. Year to year, Bitcoin is down 22% from where it was last year. The bottom line is that if you really think that Trump's pick at the Federal Reserve is going to fix the fiat dollar, it's going to fix the budget deficit and all these other structural problems that have been accumulating, if you think it's really going to fix the flight away from the dollar after what Biden and Trump have done with sanctions, I don't think that's going to happen. I see this as another one of these issues, just like Yukon Cornelius said. We did that commercial with Yukon Cornelius because everybody was thinking that Bitcoin was going to be the way to go because Trump is going to do everything to fix Bitcoin. And so we saw a dip in the price of gold and silver that lasted for a few weeks. And then people realized that Trump really wasn't going to do this Bitcoin reserve. I hope he doesn't. That'd be a tremendous pump and dump and waste of taxpayer money. But the after people realized that wasn't going to happen, then gold and silver resumed in terms of reacting to the real world that is out there. I think the same thing is going to happen here. When you have something that goes up the tremendous amount that gold and silver went up, there's going to be a retracing and a consolidation, and then I think it's going to continue to go because I don't think any of the fundamentals have changed. As I said at the very beginning of the program, changing the chair of the Federal Reserve is no different than rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic. Folks, we're still headed for the iceberg, and they're not talking about that. They're not warning anybody about that. And we are nearer, my God, to thee, to this financial crash and implosion than we have ever been. And so, again, if you want to get into something that is, when you look at some of the alternatives, right? Why are central banks and others buying gold rather than treasury bills? It's not just because of the weaponization of financial markets, but it's also because the interest rates right now are at about 3 to 3.5% that they're paying people on these treasury bills. And yet, you know, that's about what inflation is. So your best case example is maybe you're going to break even at zero growth if you're investing in that. And then what's the other alternative? Are you going to invest in the stock market? There's only a couple of stocks that are going up. And the stocks that are going up look like they are involved in the irrational exuberance over the artificial intelligence market. I think the best approach, as Tony Arterman has said many times, is dollar cost averaging. Gradually accumulate this stuff over time to even out these spikes and troughs and things like that. Get it over a period of time. You can do that as a regular savings program with Wolfpack, which is something that nobody else I know of does. And you can find where all that stuff is at davidknight.gold. Thank you for joining us. Have a good day, and good luck investing in this difficult environment. So we'll go ahead and end the show here, Lance.
That's right, boys and girls. There's a post-election sale on silver and gold. Trump euphoria has caused a dip in silver and gold. It's time to buy some metals with fiat dollars before they come to their sense. Is go to davidknight.gold to get in touch with the wise wolf himself, Tony Arterburn. He knows where to look to find silver and gold.
Common man. They created Common Core to dumb down our children. They created Common Pass to track and control us. Their Commons Project to make sure the commoners own nothing. And the communist future. They see the common man as simple, unsophisticated, ordinary. But each of us has worth and dignity created in the image of God. That is what we have in common. That is what they want to take away. Their most powerful weapons are isolation, deception, intimidation. They desire to know everything about us while they hide everything from us. It's time to turn that around and expose what they want to hide. Please share the information and links you'll find at thedavidknightshow.com. Thank you for listening,
Thank you for sharing. If you can't support us financially, please keep us in your prayers. TheDavidKnightShow.com.